Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Ray Graff. In studio this afternoon is Dr. Sarah Levin, a board-certified cardiologist and electrophysiologist for New Vance Health. She sees patients at the Heart Center's Poughkeepsie, New York, and Sharon, Connecticut offices. Her focus is on disorders of the cardiac conduction system, including arrhythmia mapping and ablation, as well as cardiac device implementation and management. Dr. Levin completed her training at New York Presbyterian Hospital and the Yale University School of Medicine. To participate in today's discussion, call 800-348-2551. Once again, the number to call in with your heart health questions is 800-348-2551. You can also email voxpop at wamc.org. Dr. Sarah Levin, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Before we go to people's questions, let's do a little, well, could you get a little closer to your mic, please?
Sure thing.
You can feel free to pull it to you. Let's do a little vocabulary from what I already read so everybody's on the same sort of page. Your focus is on disorders of the cardiac conduction system.
Yes, that is correct. So a simple way to think about it is that the heart is a pump and it has all the same features any pump has, or it's like your house, right? So you have your general contractor who works on the general parts of your house. That's your general cardiologist. You have the plumbers who do the stents, and they're my colleagues who work on the arteries. And then there's an electrical system in the heart. And so I'm the electrician.
Okay.
And so we have a number of electricians and we're called electrophysiologists.
How did you land in that specialty? I almost said speciality, which is not exactly right. Specialty.
So I fell in love with cardiology in medical school. And then I had some outstanding mentors who were electrophysiologists. And I learned about the electrical system and the fact that within electrophysiology, we have a lot of things that we do that make people feel a whole lot better. So we put in pacemakers to keep the heart from going too slow, which really helps people lead their fullest lives. We have defibrillators, which prevent sudden cardiac death, which is very important. And we have ablation procedures where we can actually modify the circuitry of the heart to take care of highly symptomatic and potentially dangerous arrhythmias for people. So it's really fun because we can make a really positive impact on people. And also, it's a lot of problem solving. Every person's electrical system is different. Every case we do is different. So every day is new and a new challenge.
The phone number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Could you tell me more about ablation specifically?
Sure. So ablation is a type of procedure that we use to modify the electrical circuitry of the heart to change its conduction properties. So there's an electrical circuitry that goes through the heart, and sometimes parts of that circuit are abnormal. So somebody may have an extra wire that they're born with. They may have a spot that's just very irritable and acting up. They may have a chaotic, disorganized rhythm in the upper chamber called atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm. And by using ablation, which just is a word for basically damaging tissue in a very focaled way, we can either use heat or cold, and now there's something called pulse field, to basically modify the heart tissue in a very, very small level, just millimeters, to tweak that electrical activity to eradicate those abnormal rhythms or reduce them.
And what kind of equipment or procedure is involved in ablation?
Sure thing. So it's a procedure that typically is done through vascular access, oftentimes from the lower extremities. The access can be either in the arteries or the veins. It just depends on where we're going and what we're looking at. And it's with very thin little tubes. Those tubes allow us to advance things called catheters, which are movable, deflectable wires, if you will, up into the heart. At that point in time, we can both measure the electrical activity of the heart locally. We do procedures. I do what are called pacing maneuvers to actually put people into the various rhythms we're thinking about. We test the rhythms. We actually determine exactly what that mechanism is. And then once we've done all of that, it's very clear where we have to, or it guides us and where we have to go to get rid of it. There are other procedures, such as we do for atrial fibrillation, that are more anatomically based, where we know that there's certain targets that are typical, and we go after those.
You said that ablation can be done with heat, cold, or a newer thing called, you said?
Pulsed field.
Pulsed field. how does that work differently from heat and cold? What is the, how does
so
it,
it's just
how
a,
does it work?
It's just a different mechanism for causing tissue damage.
Okay.
So with cold, you freeze it. With heat, you heat it. And with pulse field, you make
pulse
little
it.
Tiny holes in the cells so that they don't function anymore.
All right.
At a basic level.
How soon after an ablation procedure do you know if it worked?
So with some of our ablations, we know immediately. With other of our ablations, there's a period of healing. Each of those ablation lesions is a burn or some other damage to the tissue, so there's inflammation. So sometimes we can see some irritability right after ablation. But with certain ablations, 95%+ of the time, once we leave that lab, we're the electrophysiology lab where we do them, mm-hmm. we're fairly certain that we're not going to see that arrhythmia again. Other ablations are done for rhythms that are more chronic, and we don't expect that they will be fully gone, but we use the ablation as a way to manage them
sure.
and reduce them over time.
That makes a lot of sense. 800-348-2551 to call up with your questions for Dr. Sarah Levin from New Vance Health. 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. And I am going to take a first question from the email inbox over here. This is from Ed, who says, hello, Dr. Levin. Is supplementing with vitamin K2, heart healthy? If so, what would be the proper dose? Is that something in your area of expertise?
So thank you for that question. There's been some variable information regarding K2. As an electrophysiologist and a cardiologist, it's not something that's currently broadly incorporated into our guidelines. But certainly speaking with your own provider to see if it may be an appropriate supplement for you and at what dose would be appropriate.
Rebecca writes in to voxpop@wamc.org and says, and these are going to be abbreviations that if you know them, then you can clarify them for all of us.
Sure.
I have PVCS.
PVCs, premature ventricular contractions.
Yes. And my husband has PACs.
Premature atrial contractions.
All right. Thank you. We have been told that they are not dangerous, and I was wondering what they are, what causes them, and why they're considered safe in this instance.
Sure. So normally the electrical system in the heart, and I would draw this if I was in my office, starts in a small group of cells in the upper chamber. It's called your SA node. It's your own inborn pacemaker, makes all your normal heartbeats throughout your entire life. That impulse then goes through a relay station and down to a wiring system. Any cell in either the upper or the lower chamber outside of that electrical system can, if conditions are right, create an electrical impulse out of turn. I refer to them as interrupting beats. If you have kids, you know what I'm talking about. If you have certain coworkers, you know what I'm talking about. But they interrupt the normal conversation between the upper and the lower chamber. It is very common for people to have some of them, okay? Premature atrial contractions come from the upper chamber. Premature ventricular contractions from the lower chamber. If there are too many of them, if they cause symptoms, absolutely they warrant treatment of various sorts, and that's definitely something to speak to your provider about. Particularly premature ventricular beats, if there are a very, very high number of them, they are something that you will want to have evaluated to see if you do need a little management for them so that they don't stress your heart out over time. If your heart is structurally normal, then it is true they're not generally a high-risk rhythm. But of course, if you're having symptoms of any sort, you want to get it looked at.
800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Let's take our first call and go to Brenda in Amherst. Hello, Brenda.
Hello. I am a 58-year-old female, and I'm a year and a half post kind of a moderate brain injury. Okay.
Oh, Brenda, you're going in and out. We might have to...
Can you hear me?
I can. Try again.
Let me switch, sorry.
Hello?
Oh, hello. So you're a year out from a moderate... Hello?
Yeah.
No good?
Can you hear me?
We can. Can you hear us?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, great. Sorry. 58-year-old female, year and a half post-moderate brain injury. I've been having... what feels like kind of abnormal, kind of like arrhythmia in the heart the last couple of weeks. After I eat sugar, become very sensitive to sugar. I have a family history of type 1 diabetes, mother, brother. Father had arrhythmia and slow. I'm just wondering if there's connection between any of this, and I have not gotten anything checked out yet.
Hi, Brenda. Thank you for that question. I'm sorry about your injury. I hope you're healing up from that. Absolutely. The heart functions and does its thing with its own electrical system, but you cannot separate the heart from everything else in the body, including the brain, right? There is definitely a mind-body, a brain-heart connection of sorts. Whether or not there's a direct association between your injury and these symptoms is unclear. Certainly the heart can be very reactive to changes in the state of the body. Certainly elevated blood sugar can impact heart and heart rhythms and what the rate of the heart is and what the rhythm is. So, if you are having new symptoms that are of concern, it's definitely worth getting checked out to see if it might be related or if it's potentially related to something separate than your accident.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Brenda. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. It is time now for an underwriting break. We will return with Dr. Sarah Levin of New Vance Health after this.
Support for WAMC comes from Ambrose Electric Standby Power, an electrical contractor providing sales, service, and installation of residential and commercial Generac automatic standby generators, serving the Greater Capital District for over 40 years. AmbroseLEC.com. Kurosaki Dental Arts, helping patients smile with confidence for over 20 years, caring about patients' health and happiness. Information at KurosakiDentist.com. The Mount, Edith Wharton's Home, Lenox. Annual summer lectures featuring Lauren Groff, Jonathan Eig, Sophia Sinclair, and Jonathan Alter, among others. EdithWharton.org for information. New York Oncology, local cancer care with 34 providers across 6 Capital Region locations, offering second opinions and telehealth visits. NewYorkOncologyHematology.com. And Kara Moore in Katona, New York, presenting Apollo's Fire in Vivaldi's The Four Seasons with soprano Amanda Forsyth. Tickets at KaraMoore.org.
Welcome back to Vox Pop. It is Medical Monday. The phone number, 800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551, or the email address, voxpop@wamc.org. How are you feeling so far, Dr. Levin?
So far, so good.
So far, so good. Let us go to Ken in
that's
Malta.
Me.
Hello,
I got
Ken.
Yeah.
Yep, that's you.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question, Ken?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I go through periods where I am awoken, like last night, 3 or 4 times with a rapid heart rate, probably about 120 beats a minute. It always is right after I have a dream wherein, for various reasons, I'm frustrated trying to do something. I can settle the heart down probably within 15 seconds after, I wake up with this rapid heart rate. Is there anything to be concerned about?
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for calling in. And that's a really good question. It's something that a lot of people experience. So as I referred to with one of the prior questions, there's absolutely a connection between the mind, the brain, and the heart. And whatever's going on in the body can impact the heart and the heart rate. So if you wake up with a start, if you have a distressing or maybe a particularly joyful dream, absolutely your heart rate can go up. If, however, you notice a new pattern, or if the symptoms don't resolve, or if they persist and they're symptomatic, you also want to make sure that you get checked out and make sure that there is not something apart from the normal response to basically different types of stimulation in the body.
Okay, that's terrific. I appreciate it very much.
Sure.
Thank you for your call, Ken. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Continuing with calls, we'll go to Catherine in Cambridge. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, good afternoon. I was calling about left bundle branch block, which I was diagnosed with a couple of years ago. I have no symptoms that I know of. I'm wondering, and I don't know when it happened. So can you tell me a little more about left bundle branch block? How someone gets it? Does it ever go away on its own? And is there anything I should be concerned about?
Sure thing, Catherine. That's a great question. So the electrical system of the heart, so that heartbeat starts in the upper chambers and starts in a group of cells in the upper chamber called your SA node. It then goes through a relay station called the AV node, which just means atrioventricular. It's a relay station that coordinates the activity from the upper to the lower chamber. It then branches out to a right bundle and a left bundle, which is a branching system of wires, which then go down to the different parts of the lower chamber, sort of branch out, ramify, if you will, into lots of little wires, and then that's how the electrical system makes the heart contract. A left bundle branch block means that the electrical impulse is going slightly slower, or sometimes not at all, down the left wire compared to the right. Now, there are different types of left bundle branch block. There's left bundle branch block, which comes and goes depending on what your heart rate is. That's called a rate-related left bundle branch block. We see that in a lot of young, healthy people. We see bundle branch blocks in people who have unhealthy hearts. And so if somebody is diagnosed with a bundle branch block, a left bundle branch block in particular, one of the first things a lot of cardiologists will do is an ultrasound of the heart or an echocardiogram, just to make sure that the heart is structurally normal. If your heart is structurally normal, if your heart rate goes up appropriately with activity, if you're not having any symptoms, then it's simply a product of the way your electrical system is acting at this point in time. If, however, we start to see abnormal behavior in the electrical system, perhaps more impulses are getting blocked, and that could potentially be more serious. But we do see a lot of people with an asymptomatic, stable left bundle branch block. We simply do EKGs intermittently and keep an eye on it. One thing I should mention is that if you are somebody who is treated for hypertension, hypertension is one of the most common causes of conduction problems in the heart. And so if you are somebody who does have a hypertension, it's going to be paramount to have good blood pressure control to help prevent that bundle branch block from progressing over time.
Okay, great. Thankfully, I have extremely low blood pressure, so okay. I'm lucky there.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call, Catherine. Dr. Levin, I cannot believe how many times you just said left bundle branch block without stuttering or stammering or tripping over it, I should say. That's incredible. If you have a, you know, electrophysiology doesn't work out, you can switch to radio.
Yeah.
But it seems like you're well within hand in your chosen profession. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or the email address voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go now to Lynn in Shelburne, Mass. Hello, Lynn.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have experienced something called syncope. Can you explain that to me a little bit?
Sure, absolutely. So syncope is defined as a sudden unheralded loss of consciousness and postural tone. So what happens in syncope is somebody suddenly loses consciousness, sometimes with warning, sometimes without warning. Typically, it is recovered rapidly. This is different than some neurologic situations where there can be prolonged loss of consciousness. Now, syncope is a very significant problem. There are benign types of syncope and there are more high-risk types of syncope. When I say benign types of syncope, I mean not typically life-threatening. I don't mean that they're not impactful to the person having them. But so when a young person locks their legs up and they're, you know, singing in the chorus concert and on their risers and boop, down they go, that's a type of syncope we see in oftentimes young, healthy hearts. The type of syncope where somebody may see a scary movie or when they get blood drawn and they know it's coming and they can tell that it's going to happen. That's often something we call vasovagal syncope, which has to do with an imbalance in the body of heart rate and blood pressure. Then there's other types of syncope, which we see in people who do not have structurally normal hearts. And in that case, we need to make sure that the person may not need something called a pacemaker or a defibrillator, or that they're having a heart rhythm, which puts them at risk of something. So when somebody has syncope, 80% of the identification of the process is through a close history that you would provide in consultation with your doctor, with a cardiologist, with an electrophysiologist. And then based on the situation, the company it keeps, if you will, then they'll determine the next appropriate testing. But it can be quite distressing and impactful. Absolutely.
It definitely a little surprising when it happens. Well, thank you so much. That was very helpful.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for your call, Lynn. The phone number, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We are in studio with Dr. Sarah Levin, a board-certified cardiologist and electrophysiologist for New Vance Health. We have another question in the old email inbox. George writes in and says, can you explain the impact of heavy alcohol consumption on the heart? Is that something you're comfortable doing or is it not?
Sure, okay. Absolutely. So heavy alcohol consumption has several definitions. So for women, the recommendation is at most one drink a day, and I tell my patients not all saved up for Friday. For men, just because of the way the metabolisms and the body mass tends to be, it's two. There's a lot of debate that that's probably even too lenient, but certainly more than three drinks on any given occasion is verging into the realm of binge drinking. So heavy alcohol affects multiple organ systems. It absolutely has negative impacts on the heart. I'll touch on non-electrophysiologic issues to begin with. So heavy alcohol use acutely and over time has very deleterious effects on blood pressure. So it is a big contributor to chronic hypertension, which is a major contributor to cardiac morbidity and mortality in our country and globally. So that is one reason to avoid it. Two, very heavy alcohol use over time can cause the heart pump to fail. There's something called an alcohol-mediated cardiomyopathy, where people's hearts will just stop pumping well. If we cannot turn this around, this definitely impacts people's longevity. It hastens morbidity and mortality by leading to heart failure. So very heavy alcohol use over time is very deleterious to the heart pump. And then from an electrical perspective, alcohol use at all, although historically heavy, was thought to be a common trigger for atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation used to be called holiday heart, where you go out and overdo it and you'd come in with this rapid irregular rhythm called atrial fibrillation. Now we know that really any alcohol can be a trigger for atrial fibrillation for certain people. So many reasons to be super moderate.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Back to the phones and to Chris in Clarksville. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I'm calling because I was wondering about what the accuracy is for smartwatches. I've been getting notifications of a low heart rate at night and a low oxygen sat. And I was just wondering if I should be concerned with those.
Chris, that's a great question. I get this almost on a regular basis. So there's so many different options for wearable technology right now. And it seems pandemic and beyond, we've really started to be very aware of monitoring our own vital signs, which can be mm-hmm. both a positive and a negative, depending on the situation. There's some really great wearable technology out there for AFib and arrhythmia identification. Several manufacturers do have some fairly reliable algorithms for that. The mm-hmm. data about heart rate, particularly overnight, needs to be taken in context with what normal hearts do at night. So then during sleep, it's a period of healing and recovery. And so it is normal and appropriate for your heart rate to go down, and it will nadir or will go to its very lowest point, typically in the, you know, depending on your sleep-wake cycle, but, you know, often 3, 4, or 5 in the morning, you may get heart rates down into the 40s if you're a young, healthy person with normal physiology. And that's
well,
okay.
I do have bradycardia, and the notifications I've been getting, they're starting to go into like the 39 and 38.
Right. And
but I'm not.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
I don't have any other symptoms.
Sure. And what we look at as cardiologists and electrophysiologists is what that heart rate does during the day. So when the heart rate goes down at night, that's very common. What's normal then is that when you're up and moving around and doing your activity, that that heart rate goes up appropriately for you and what you need it to be doing. If, however, the bradycardia persists while you're awake and the heart rate does not go up appropriately, that is something of concern and should definitely be looked at. Slow heart rates at night can also be a sign of sleep apnea in some people. So if there's any concern for sleep apnea, that's also something that should be investigated.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chris.
1-800-348-2551, the phone number to call in on this Medical Monday Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Feeling good? Keep the calls rolling? All right. Shrug, she says. Let's go now to Colin in Poughkeepsie. Hello, Colin.
Hi. I was diagnosed in my mid-20s with a condition called Wolff-Parkinson-White. I wore a monitor for 2 weeks and was told at the time this is what was going on, and they just the cardiologist recommended an annual checkup after that. I did not do the annual checkup and recently went to see a cardiologist for that checkup, so about 8 years had passed, and now the cardiologist is recommending a series of more extensive tests and potentially a procedure to correct the pathway that I have as part of the condition. So I'm just wondering what might have made a cardiologist 8 years ago, granted when I was younger, recommend basically less intensive intervention, if it was something about age or something else.
No, thank you for that question, Colin. So Wolff-Parkinson-White, named for three folks who elucidated the process, is also called pre-excitation or ventricular pre-excitation. So going back to the electrical system where the signal from the upper chamber goes through a relay station, what happens in Wolff-Parkinson-White or pre-excitation is that you were born with a wire called a bypass track, which is outside of the normal conduction system. This can be a benign wire that does not cause you trouble, and monitoring would be appropriate. It could also be a more high-risk pathway, which could lead to abnormal heart rhythms, potentially dangerous heart rhythms that could put you at risk. So when somebody's identified as having ventricular pre-excitation or Wolff-Parkinson-White, we do some basic testing, including monitoring and a stress test. And there are certain features that can be found on that testing, which tells the doctor at that point that that is a low-risk pathway. So if it stops conducting or just becomes absent at a certain heart rate, we know that that pathway is not necessarily going to put you at risk. If, however, you're having palpitations, if you're having fluttering, if you're having symptoms of rapid heartbeats out of the blue, symptoms of fainting or near fainting, or if they're now concerned that maybe the pathway is not a low-risk pathway, then other evaluations can be performed. Those can be anything from wearable monitors to a treadmill test, which tells us what the behavior of the pathway is at higher heart rates. And it can be invasive. So we do an electrophysiology study where we actually identify the electrical parameters or the abilities of that pathway to potentially put somebody at risk. We do testing to see if it does participate in any abnormal heart rhythms, which could also be problematic. And if anything does indicate that this pathway does put you at risk for a fast or dangerous abnormal heart rhythm, then we do oftentimes do what's called ablation or focal modification of that pathway to eliminate that risk or symptoms. So it may just been the data at that time. Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for the call, Colin. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or voxpop at wamc.org. This from the inbox. Deborah writes in and says, about 8 years ago, after passing out while exercising, my husband was diagnosed with an electrical issue and a pacemaker was inserted. His heart is almost exclusively reliant on the pacemaker to continue beating. The reason for this happening has never been identified. Would you have any idea about what might cause this level of damage in an otherwise very active and healthy person? Seems like you don't maybe have enough information, but feel free to.
Yeah, no, that's that is a, you know, it's obviously a conundrum. So It sounds like your husband was diagnosed with some form of conduction disturbance, type of heart block, where those signals are not going from the upper chamber to the lower chamber. There's different reasons for it. There are congenital and heritable forms. We don't really have all the genetics, you know, highlighted for those. Oftentimes it happens with age, but unfortunately, when we do see it in younger people, we can't always pinpoint exactly what did cause that stress to the conduction system.
800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back with your calls for Dr. Sarah Levin, board-certified cardiologist and electrophysiologist for Nuvance Health, after this. Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Ray Graff this week. The phone number 800-348-2551. And our guest is Dr. Sarah Levin, board-certified cardiologist and electrophysiologist for Nuvance Health. She sees patients in Poughkeepsie, New York, and Sharon, Connecticut. Back to the phones, Dr. Levin?
Absolutely.
Okie doke. Let's go now to Kate in South Hadley, Mass. Hello, Kate.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it. This whole episode has been very intriguing and informative. So in a nutshell, I have family history, but somehow at age 65, I've been virtually unscathed by heart issues. My mom had AFib. She had all sorts of complications with heart. She was on high blood pressure, most of her medication, most of her life. And I found out 6 years ago that I have a full-blooded sister who lives in another state, and she also has the hypertension and the whole nine yards that my mom had. My question pertains to heart murmur. When I was in grade school, I was diagnosed as having a heart murmur, and it was pronounced enough that I started seeing a cardiologist once a year for an echogram and whatnot. When I graduated from, and they were always saying, you know, don't do too many stressful sports and, you know, just kind of take it easy. If you feel short of breath, you know, stop what you're doing. Well, I was on ski team. I was on field hockey team. I engaged in as many, you know, very strenuous sports and really didn't see any issues. Fast forward, I graduated from college and my cardiologist said, congratulations, we don't seem to see any sign of a heart murmur anymore. So he gave me a clean bill of health and I go on with my life. I'm now 65. And last year, at a physical, my general practitioner, she said, oh, she's like, I detect a heart murmur. And I said, oh, really? And so fast forward, I was sent for an echocardiogram and now they're telling me I should probably get one yearly. Any idea of why nothing for so many years and I've lived my life as normally and stress-free as I can, and now I seem to have some kind of heart murmur come back or another one develop. I don't know.
So that's a great question, Kate. So a heart murmur describes the sound that blood makes when it moves from one chamber of the heart to another, and then out.
Right.
Typically, it's through these entities or these things called heart valves, which are sort of check valves, which mm-hmm. prevent the blood from going one place back to another. So a lot of young people have heart murmurs, which are generally described as flow murmurs. They can be due to congenital heart disease, but it sounds like you were monitored closely and appropriately, and that's, you know, you grew out of that murmur, perhaps. That does not mean that at another point in life you could not develop either a recurrent whooshing sound through a valve related to maybe a change in the initial area that they were looking at, or perhaps developing a new murmur, perhaps through a different spot in the heart. So we
lucky
have
me.
Yeah, and they're very common. I think if you look at the data, anywhere between 20% and 40% of us have some form of murmur. Those murmurs mm-hmm. can come and go depending on the day. certain murmurs, which if they do show either leakiness or narrowing through one of the heart valves, they do warrant monitoring over time with serial, what we call echocardiograms or ultrasounds. Very often, whatever that abnormality is stable, but there are certain ones that we want to make sure that they don't progress because they can be a sign of malfunction of one of the heart valves that sometimes does need intervention, either through a catheter or surgically. We would rather know about those changes ahead of time and so that we can, you know, act on anything that might need to be acted on before it has a negative impact on you. It may be a new issue without knowing what the data was that your prior doctors had.
Yeah.
But certainly having a murmur, having ultrasounds intermittently, not uncommon, and it sounds like an appropriate course of action.
Okay. And I've never, thank God, had high blood pressure. I've never been on medication. I always, you know, even through pregnancies or through major stressful things in my life, my blood pressure has always remained completely in the, you know, mid normal section. So, I know these are two different issues.
They're not totally unrelated. So I'm glad you brought the blood pressure up, because when people say, what can I do to make my heart valves happy and keep whatever maybe leakiness or narrowing from getting worse? One of the most important things is good blood pressure control, because if you do not have good blood pressure control, that just puts a lot of stress on the heart, and particularly these very delicate heart valves. So absolutely, it's really great that you have good blood pressure, and it's definitely something you want to, you know, keep working on.
Okay. I appreciate all your information, and thank you again.
Thank you for calling, Kate.
You have a good day.
Thank you for taking my call.
Of course. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Let's go now to Jerry in Kinderhook. Hello, Jerry.
Hi, Dr. Levin. Thank you for taking my call, and Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about ablation procedure. Specifically, I understand there's a burning technique and then there's a freezing technique, and I just wondered if you could talk about the difference in those techniques and maybe which one is better or something like that.
Sure, Jerry. So absolutely, there's different ways of basically modifying or damaging heart tissue in a very focal way. Radio frequency ablation or heat is probably the predominant form of ablation. Cryoablation is cooling, and for a long time, and by a lot of people, it is utilized in areas where we're nervous about maybe causing damage to another part of the electrical system. So with cryoablation, it's a more gradual process, so we can start to see if maybe we're impacting parts of the electrical system we don't want to impact. Then we come off, the tissue thaws, and it's not permanently damaged. So it is utilized in certain situations. Some people use it for AFib ablation. There's absolutely positives to each form of ablation. Which one is best for each patient and each arrhythmia, that's usually determined by the electrophysiologist doing the procedure. There's not really one is better than the other. Each has positives and each has pluses and minuses.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you so much for explaining it. I appreciate it.
Sure. Have a great day, Jerry. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And let's go. We have two Joannes on the phone, so I'm going to Salt Point. Here I go. Joanne, Salt Point, hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My husband is 70 years old. At his last physical, he had a heart murmur, and when they checked it out, they said he has aortic stenosis, and he does have hypertension. I just wondered if you could explain that a little bit more.
Sure thing. So the aortic valve is the valve that allows the blood to go from the main pumping chamber of the left ventricle out the heart through the aorta to your body. So it's the main exit valve, if you will, from the heart. Typically, if you looked at the aortic valve sort of en face or down at it, it looked like a peace sign or a Mercedes-Benz sign, I guess, depending on where you're coming at. And some people are born with just two leaflets, and that looks more like a little fish mouth. Now, over time, that valve, those leaflets can get stiff and they can get stuck shut. And if you think about the doors in a restaurant, right, they swing wide open coming from the kitchen into the dining room and everybody can come out and it works smoothly. Imagine that door only opened in maybe an inch and everybody had to leave the kitchen through a tiny little opening. So when the aortic valve is narrowed, the blood cannot leave the heart efficiently. That puts a lot of stress on the heart muscle. Over time, if it gets very narrowed, it can be something that needs to be replaced, and that can be done surgically or with catheters. People can have mild aortic stenosis, which is just slight narrowing that really doesn't impact blood flow, but that is something that does need to be monitored with ultrasounds over time. How frequently will depend on each person's valve and situation, just to make sure that it does not progress. Definitely very important for your husband to work on good blood pressure control, because that blood pressure will impact that valve over time.
Okay.
Anything else, Joanne? All right. Thank you for your call.
Just to say, is the surgery serious, I guess? How serious is the surgery?
So, great question. If it got to the point where your husband needed to have an aortic valve replacement, there's two different ways that that's done. Historically or traditionally, we did something called surgical aortic valve replacement, or SAVR. That's a procedure done by a cardiothoracic surgery. That's a major open heart surgery. Patients are put on the heart-lung machine or bypass for that. However, surgeons do it. Cardiothoracic surgeons do it regularly, and they do a fabulous job. More recently, we have something called TAVR, or transaortic valve replacement. This is the ability to replace the aortic valve through catheter-based procedures that do not require a sternotomy, usually an overnight stay in the hospital, oftentimes without even general anesthesia. So very commonly, aortic valves are now being able to be replaced with a much more minimally invasive procedure with a nice, quick healing time. Not without risk. Most people don't wake up in the morning and say, hey, I want a new aortic valve. But absolutely, if it gets to the point where that valve is seriously narrowed and causing problems, very good, safe technologies for fixing it.
Oh, that's a big relief. And thank you so much. I really appreciate your great explanation and the reassurance.
All right. Thank you for calling and for listening. 800-348-2551. We'll go now to Carolyn in Loudonville. Hello, Carolyn.
Hello.
Hi there.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. I have AFib. My primary care suggested that I have a Watchman. I talked with my cardiologist, and he said, you seem to be doing well on Eliquis. I would say, why change?
That's a good question. It's a very common topic. So with atrial fibrillation, which is an abnormal rhythm in the upper chamber of the heart, the upper chamber can beat really quickly and irregularly. And when it does that, blood is not moving through the heart appropriately. And if blood sits and stagnates, it can clot. And so AFib is associated with increased risk of stroke. That's why your doctor has you on Eliquis. So it's one of our medicines that we use to reduce that risk. Some people cannot safely be on blood thinners, or for various reasons, blood thinners are not optimal, and therefore we have things called left atrial appendage occlusion devices. Basically, it's a windsock. The left atrial appendage is sort of a windsock off the left atrium where the blood stagnates, and the Watchman is one of those left atrial appendage occlusion devices. It's basically a little plug that's inserted during a procedure into that windsock where the blood clots form, thereby sealing it off and limiting the risk of stroke. It was originally approved for people who have AFib and are not able to safely tolerate blood thinners. So anytime you have a procedure or a medication, the discussion that you had with your doctor is the appropriate one. What's the risk of each of those approaches? What's the benefit of each of those approaches? And then at any given time in your situation, you make a decision at that time. Decision at one point may not be the decision you have at another point. But, you know, it is a very good technology that's out there. And in certain situations, it may be very appropriate.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your call. And have a wonderful afternoon. 800-348-2551 or voxpop@wamc.org. Cheryl writes in and says, I have recently had several episodes of a sensation of a rush of blood from my heart to my head, followed by lightheadedness and a rapid heart rate. Then it goes away. I've had many tests without any diagnosis, including a 14-day monitor. I am being told it's likely anxiety. Can anxiety cause that type of sensation? I've had panic attacks in the past, but this feels much different with the hot flush to my head. I know you're not a anxiety diagnostic, but...
So, thank you for that question. So, I think a lot of times people may go back to this identity or idea of anxiety if they can't identify what is going on. That may or may not be the case. I think that the symptoms you describe are very consistent with a potential abnormal heart rhythm, some type of arrhythmia either from the upper or the lower chamber. It's a real symptom, and it bears sorting out. With monitors, I don't consider them diagnostic unless I captured an episode of what you're having during that monitoring period. So I think if you did not have one of those episodes during the monitoring period, we can't say for sure if it's due to an abnormal heart rhythm or something else going on in the body, okay? There are some devices out there that can record EKGs. You could sort of maybe do some monitoring yourself. There are longer-term monitors that can be utilized as well. But as an electrophysiologist, and I see a lot of women, I don't usually hearken right to anxiety until I've really ruled out some pathophysiology, which, you know, would bear looking into. If you've had an echo and the heart's structurally normal, if everything's been seen on the monitor is benign, then most likely whatever this is not dangerous. Doesn't mean it's not symptomatic. So, you know, if you're not feeling particularly anxious at those times, I can't say if it is or is not anxiety, but I think that until you've actually captured an episode of what you're having on some form of monitoring, it would be hard to rule out an arrhythmia of sorts.
Let's see if we can fit one more call in before the end of the show. This is Susan in Rhinebeck. Hello, Susan.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can.
Good. I have a myocardial bridge, and I understand there's a new operation. There hasn't been any operation for a long time. I mean, since I can remember. For myocardial bridge, and I'm wondering if the doctor can explain a little bit about that and, you know, who are candidates for it, because I'm 80 years old.
Susan, thank you for that question. So a myocardial bridge, as you know, is when the coronary arteries, which normally run on the outside of the heart, dive down into the heart muscle. Many, many times these do not cause problems, but absolutely sometimes when the heart squeezes, it can impact that artery and it can contract blood flow, which can cause symptoms and problems to the person who has the bridge. Now, sometimes a cardiothoracic surgeon will do what's called unroofing of the bridge. I would defer discussion of who's a candidate for that, who's not, probably to the surgeons. As to new technologies, I, again, am not aware of any changes in that. Sorry about that.
That is the last word on the show. Susan, thank you for calling in. Sorry to cut you up abruptly there. We are about out of time, but I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to the people we left on the line. Thank you to Dr. Sarah Levin of New Vance Health for joining us today. You are marvelous.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Medical Monday comes from Music Haven, presenting the traditional Celtic music of Gowitsha in Schenectady Central Park this Sunday at 7 p.m. Open to the public, musichavenstage.org. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Bob Rathbun for answering the phones. I'm Sarah LeDuc. Tomorrow on Vox Pop, we'll get real estate tips. That is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Stay tuned now for the best of our knowledge.